In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Some of the deep esoteric topics covered on this show include They Walk Among Us, non-humans masquerading as humans, for example, and is an alien race terraforming Earth under the pretense of an unauthorized geoengineering operation? These were the leading far-out theories, one of which had gotten this show canceled on a station in New York City many years ago. However, our society, I believe, has become much more receptive to these discussions. Recent past shows have examined Gnostic beliefs touching upon the foundations of living in the Westworld reincarnation trap and simulation. These topics, such as They Walk Among Us and the terraforming, logically extend toward the well-known quote by Charles Fort, "The Earth is a farm and we are someone else's property." In this show, I'll attempt to shade in some areas of the elusive hidden predator brought to public awareness through the tireless work of author, retired police investigator, and documentarian David Politis. His Missing 411 book series and related documentaries have revealed how thousands of people mysteriously vanish in U.S. national parks. And he reports on how the federal government is oddly and deliberately obfuscating investigations into the cases. It's a familiar blockade interference that also surrounds alien abduction and aerosol operations. Within the Missing 411 series, it appears an ancient predator is effortlessly abducting humans with an impossible 100% accuracy. Politis has written more than 10 books in the 411 series with specific profile points. Now, after more than a decade, those profile points are quickly recognized within the public domain as potential signs of a missing 411 case. There are several categories, or rather elimination points, that make the missing 411 cases unique and reveal a pattern, and those are: animal and human predation are ruled out. Also, suicide is ruled out. Mental illness ruled out. Drownings and a faked death are ruled out. Let's now look at the profile points that shape the missing person 411 cases. They include canines can't find a scent during search and rescue. Weather conditions cause interference during search and rescue. Victims are often found in areas previously searched several times over. Missing clothes or shoes are a factor. A pattern in the times of disappearance. There's a disability or illness connected to the victim. A lack of memory in recalling where the missing person had gone. The body is found near creeks, rivers, ponds, lakes, and streams. Boulders and granite play a role, as do swamps and bogs. A point of separation from the group initializes the event. And now within urban cases, the point of separation occurs when the individual will often want to head home because they're feeling suddenly unwell or very tired. National News reporter and Coast to Coast radio host George Knapp suggested to Politis during an interview that maybe the cases could expand into urban environments. Well, he was absolutely correct. David Politis published Missing 411, A Sobering Coincidence, more than 10 years ago. And ever since, these specific missing person cases were no longer confined to national parks. Was the possibility of the elusive predator being a Sasquatch, a Rake, a Dogman, or any type of creature now off the table as the missing 411 profile points matched a myriad of cases in urban environments in the cities? Could there be more than one type of predator, or is this the same apex predator? A listener from Washington State reached out to me last year, pointing me to the fascinating thesis about the hidden predator by a metaphysical researcher named Michelle DeBries. Michelle is in a different line of work now. We tried to do an interview last year, but the interference was unlike anything I've experienced. In fact, it was worse than lining up a few of the targeted individual interviews, which were very, very difficult because of the trauma the guests had endured. And that's very hard to top. In this case, with Michelle, there seemed to be a lot of external interference. Michelle referenced how this predator archetype has actually been a focus of many researchers over time, including past guest Jerry Marzinski. However, I suspect, clearly, I don't know for certain, but Jerry's work exposes a different type of predator, the parasite. But Michelle suspects it's the same thing. And the more I think about it, this is very significant because the personality and character of the etheric predator Jerry outlines is of a demonic nature, feeding off of human pain, suffering, and a range of negative energy. If you're new to Jerry's work, we'll hear an excerpt of that interview. As a reminder, Jerry Marzinski is a retired licensed psychotherapist with more than 35 years of experience counseling paranoid schizophrenics in state mental institutions, state prisons, and hospital emergency rooms. Marzinski says if psychiatry were to objectively study the voices of schizophrenics, another world would open up. They would discover the voices are not meaningless word salad. The voices have a forceful, negative pattern. Let's go now to hear Jerry describe these etheric predators in more detail in his own words.
So it took a long while just to find a few things about the voices. So I found the more I knew about them and could tell these patients, the less resistant they were to tell me more information. Yeah. So one of the first things I saw is that they started running patterns. Okay, and these patterns were, number one, the first pattern I found is that virtually everything these voices said to the patients was negative. It was negative, insulting, berating, awful, you know, just awful stuff. If it was negative or positive, they used it to turn around at some later point and stab the patient in the back with it. So they were consistently negative and abusive and nasty. And that didn't vary. So I started asking dozens of patients about, you know, what these things were saying. They were all saying the same thing. It looked like they were all these voices were made in some cosmic cookie cutter somewhere with the same script. You know, you're no good, you're ugly, you're stupid, you're nasty, nobody loves you, your parents really don't like you, why don't you just go ahead and kill yourself? All right? The same script in virtually all of these. And I found that interesting. And it was a pattern that was very consistent. It didn't vary among dozens and dozens of these schizophrenic individuals. So I got to wondering, like, what is it that holds them onto such a consistent pattern? Why aren't they random like hallucinations? Why aren't they all over the place? Why aren't some negative, some neutral, some positive, like real hallucinations? You know, why are they consistently negative? Right. So that was the first pattern. The second pattern emerged again at the state hospital when one patient came in one day and he said, the voices came and I started praying the 23rd Psalm. And I said, well, that's interesting. What happened? He said they reacted like worms thrown on a hot frying pan. And I found that interesting. So I got the 23rd Psalm and I started handing it out to some of my other schizophrenic patients who were hearing voices. And I'd tell them, when the voices come, read this Psalm and tell me what happened. Consistently, the voices reacted against the Psalm. They hated it. They demanded that they stop speaking it. They reacted very viciously toward that psalm. Then I found out that they also reacted negatively when the patient started reading the Bible or if they went to church. And I found, I did a little study on that, and I found if the voices were very weak and the patient went to church, they shut up. If they were medium strength, then voices would get louder and try to drown out the preacher so the patient couldn't hear what he was saying. So they would interfere with the sermon. And if they were very strong, they would drive the patient right out of the church. I mean, he would just get up and run. Okay.
Jerry, were you able to determine when the thoughts turned into voices? And is that something that's significant in your research?
Well, that is significant. And there's a story behind this, too. I was wondering, you know, what these voices sounded like. You know, were they different? Were they the same? What they were like. So I prayed one day, hey, Lord, let me experience these voices. You know, what are they like? Nothing happened for about 2 weeks. I brought this one patient in, and I was always asking these guys questions. I was constantly questioning them. Okay. So I brought that book into the prison with me one day, and I had this one patient sit down, and he was hearing voices. And I said, I want to read you this paragraph. And that paragraph was talking about the voices being parasites. So I started reading the book, that one paragraph, and he's listening. And then I got to the part where the author was talking about these voices being parasitic entities. Okay? And then I heard this loud crack right behind my head. You know, it was like an electrical crack. You know, like when a fuse blows. And I look around, I don't see anything. And then I hear this electrical crackling on the wall, moving toward the wall to my right. And it starts moving at a 45-degree angle up that wall, and it's crackling like an electric arc welder. It's like crack, 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 crack. And I'm like, I don't see anything. I don't smell anything. And I look at the inmate, and I said, do you hear that? And he's just staring at me with this zombie stare. You know, it was like he was hypnotized or something. He's just staring at me, and I'm like, he's going to attack. You know, so I push my chair against the back wall just in case he does so I can kick him back with my feet. And this crackling just keeps going on. So I didn't want to take my eyes off of him for any length of time. So I'm switching my attention between him and this crackling moving up the wall at a 45-degree angle. And I don't see anything. I don't smell anything. But that crackling is loud. And it's there. It's not like a 5-10 second thing. The whole thing took 25 or 30 seconds for it to, it went all around the room. It went up the right wall. It went up to the ceiling. It crackled across the ceiling.
Well, Jerry, we had been disconnected here. And it was very unusual. We spent the last hour trying to reconnect, and either your headphone microphone set died or there's been significant interference, and that's not unusual.
Something usually goes wrong with the electronics.
The more strength these entities can gain and harvest from the host and maybe nearby people, it seems the more they can manifest within our reality. That was from a 2025 interview with retired licensed psychotherapist Jerry Marzinski, and this is relating to the focus of this show, beginning to shade in the hidden predator at the center of the Missing 411 book and film series by David Politis. Jerry said one of the most important things we can learn from studying the voices is that we're surrounded by a world of spirits containing predators that are feeding on all of us to different degrees. And to my thinking, that could be these entities creating a range of effects from low-grade consistent anxiety to full-on psychosis. And I want to interject here and remind you of a recent show addressing this issue of increasing your life force and using Neville Goddard's technique to fall off the parasite's radar. To me, this is invaluable strategy to keep centered and in the present moment of pure creativity. I'll put a link on inothernewsradio.com for that show. Continuing here, Jerry says, we believe we're at the top of the food chain. Our findings reveal this isn't true. Now, it gets interesting. I connect Jerry's work to the flyers, the flying shadows Don Juan describes in Carlos Castaneda's book. Well, Michelle does the same. In fact, she goes further in her Hidden Predator thesis. Michelle writes, quote, one of Marcinski's patients confessed, if the parasites were discovered to be independent of the patient, their overlord would punish them, suggesting a hierarchy. And that's from one of the patients. Michelle writes, this is reminiscent of the Don Juan quote, the predator's mind is filled with fear of being discovered any minute now. That's from the book, The Active Side of Infinity. There it is, a glimpse into the nature of the etheric parasite, the very subject of the many in other news shows about organoid and the host-etheric parasite relationship. Past guest, author and researcher Laura Knight Yadchik uses the same author's quotes in her 1994 book titled High Strangeness, Hyperdimensions, and the Process of Alien Abduction. And let me quickly interject a note about the high strangeness here in the alien abduction context. Author William Tompkins points out in the book Selected by Extraterrestrials, there were more than 30,000 alien abductions documented at one point in 1 year. And I'm assuming that's worldwide, but it could be North America alone. Yadchik writes in Chapter 11 about Don Juan's observations. The sorcerers of ancient Mexico were the first ones to see those fleeting shadows. So they followed them around. They saw them as you're seeing them, and they saw them as energy that flows in the universe. And they discover something transcendental. They discovered that we have a companion for life. We have a predator that came out of the depths of the cosmos and took over the rules of our lives. Human beings are its prisoner. The predator is our lord and master. I want to appeal to your analytical mind, Don Juan said. Think for a moment and tell me how you would explain the contradiction between the intelligence of man, the engineer, and the stupidity of his systems of belief, or the stupidity of his contradictory behavior. Sorcerers believe that the predators gave us our systems of belief, our ideas of good and evil, our social mores. At this point in our society, we have a lot going on, and what Don Juan says here, that's very easy to justify as a predator running the show behind the scenes. But again, that was a quote on the same topic written about in Laura Knight Yadchik's book, High Strangeness, another really interesting book, Hyperdimensions and the Process of Alien Abduction. I'm moving to a lot of different topics and referencing authors, but please stay with me. Doesn't the part about the contradiction of man, the engineer, versus the stupidity of belief systems sound similar to the reincarnation trap discussion past guest Howdy McCoskey refers to in his book Exit the Cave? McCoskey is talking about false reality themes such as The Truman Show, Westworld, a rigged simulacrum with enough distraction and plausibility for those who are invested to suspend disbelief and hold together a contradictory reality. Now back to the etheric parasite as described by Don Juan Matus in how their fear of being discovered as independent of their host will affect their food supply. They don't want to be discovered. That makes sense to me. Any predator or parasite guarding the sudden awareness of their host, often the schizophrenic here, but I would consider the varying degrees referenced by Jerry, meaning the low chronic anxiety to high-level psychosis. Yet, this predator within its minions and hierarchy and legion is still in fear. If the predator is discovered, then the food source is diminished. This awareness by the host may trigger a cascading effect of victims or hosts finding out about the predator. resulting in a major loss of the predator's food source. I'm guessing that's why we're learning how the parasite's overlord would punish them if they reveal themselves to the host, and suggesting here also the hierarchy in how the energy harvested from the host might be passed through an etheric supply chain. Does this not sound like a spiritual attack, a battle royale to harvest the living waters of God's children? Let me go over what Kay Pachi, who, a young woman, looks like she's in her 20s, she references a Bible from the year 1818 here. And she says, most so-called Christians don't even know that you're supposed to keep the commandments. They don't know that that's the basis of the new covenant, that God puts his spirit in us so that we can keep all of his rules. They have no clue. Let's say that this is just a random atheist on the street, or like one of your family members or something. They come at you angry and screaming for no reason. They're operating under the exact same spirit. Why? Because the majority of the world is full of parasites and being animated by the mystery of iniquity. So again, it's another puppet. It's another NPC, which is a reference to when video games have a character that it's a non-playable character, and they can be easily influenced by the writers of the code. If the NPC can get a reaction out of you or get you to fall into sin, then legally they can basically stick a straw in you, and they take from you your living waters. They take from you your light, and through them, because they are connected to the beast, Sheol, I think, which is hell, is draining your life force. So there you go. You have the Legion connection here with those etheric parasites. But she's talking about those parasites working through individuals as well. And the energy is described as living waters. My people have been lost sheep. Their shepherds have caused them to go astray. So the shepherds caused people to go astray. This is why I believe what I believe. The Bible repeatedly says that it's always the shepherds that are corrupted. And it goes back to the red mist. And we'll talk about the mist later. They have turned them away on the mountains. They have gone from the mountain to hill. They have forgotten their resting place. So you forget because the wine, the red wine, wine of the harlot, causes forgetfulness. Everyone that found God's sheep devoured them, and their adversary said, "We offend not because they have sinned against the Lord, the habitation of justice, even the Lord, the hope of their fathers." So the enemies, like the parasitic entities, are saying we're allowed to feed on them, and it's not against the law, spiritual law, because the false shepherds blind people by spreading this red mist, by convincing them of things like faith alone and like we don't have to keep the law. That's old covenant. That's bondage. Well, guess what? The spiritual laws of the universe that God set up haven't changed. Things didn't change. They still have permission to feed on people who don't keep the commandments. That's why they forget, because their spirit is getting eaten up by the dark entities, and the dark entities are doing so lawfully because the false shepherds cause the people to think that they're dwelling in safety no matter what. And like always, this concept is attached to Babylon, the priests of Babylon, the false church. And we know Revelation says, "Come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins. Remove out of the midst of Babylon and go forth out of the land of the Chaldeans and be as he gods before the flocks. For lo, I will raise and cause to come up against Babylon an assembly of great nations from the north country, and they shall set themselves in array against her. From hence she shall be taken. Their arrows shall be as of a mighty expert man. None shall return in vain. In Ezekiel, God sends destroyer angels into his sanctuaries before the rest of the judgments even start." It doesn't have to be a person standing in front of you. I think she's talking about a psychic vampire. Sometimes it can be temptation. Let's say this person has a random temptation and they fall into it. It becomes like an addiction. Then now there's another thing that's supposed to be a straw, pulling out your living waters. And she's drawing another one of Shoal's entities feeding on their water, stealing their waters and their mana. At a certain point, if this tree is taking from the waters and not producing fruit, the person is basically a buffet for spiritual entities. That's when you get cut off and thrown into the fire. And she explains the same energy harvest dynamic written thousands of years ago with different terminology, such as the living waters and the dry places, the red mist, the Red Sea, the wine of the harlot. Again, the harvest of energy leading back to a legion of entities. In this overview of Jerry Marzinski's connection to the missing 411 hidden predator and Michel DeBrieve's thesis, an etheric predator emerges that's both urban in its direct attack on humans and rural, flying around visibly in the desert, as Don Juan describes. We'll be revisiting this realm, but now let's look at a profile point of missing persons associated with boulders and granite. This might be significant in one sense because pressure exerted onto the quartz inside the granite can produce piezoelectricity, as many listeners are familiar. Is this reaction alone a reason why there's an association with missing persons and granite? It doesn't sound like it would to most of us, but I also wonder if there might be a combined effect with this piezoelectric anomaly within the granite and field effects from ley line intersections. As you may recall, past interviews with Peter Shampoo, author of Gaia Matrix, Arcom and the Geometries of Destiny in the North American Landscape, he described how the bandwidth intersections of these ley lines are often the source of haunted houses and wild paranormal activity. Let's quickly review here what Peter Shampoo explains in this 2014 interview, one of the best interviews we did here.
So that confluence of lays and different spin fields and rivers running upstream, if you will, that whenever there's an anomalous occurrence like that, it tends to make a glitch in the matrix, and it opens up a portal. So you have a great deal of kind of mental, spiritual, psychic energy running up and down the New York City lay, and this house, from all reports, was manifesting all manner of different apparitions in Native Americans, colonials on horses, people engaged in all kinds of different activities in the middle of this living room of this house that was constructed on a lot that no one would build on or could build on. And so this family tried to move there, and they really had trouble from the get-go. From last reports from this person, this hearsay witness, going by there at night, you can often see these glowing orange lights emanating from that house that's now abandoned because it's too crazy to live there. So that's kind of ley lines where there's a great deal of vortexing going on, if you will, energies can get stuck. And like with any two streams that intersect at the crossroads is where the vortex is.
Is the vortex, in terms of energy movement, is that a swirling motion, or is what's happening there?
Concert with a pyramid or a dome. The pyramid is a dome. It's a spherical form that's just crystallized. That's another long story, but so that there's this loop that goes between the two, like a donut, like a donut situation. So there's a communication between the obelisk and the dome, or the cup and the sword. There's a whole pagan thing around the cup and the sword, and we can't really go there, but it's too broad of a subject. But it has to do with the Grail quest and all this stuff of consciousness. So if you draw a circle and you turn it counterclockwise, and you take your right hand and you turn it counterclockwise, you're going down, that energy is going down. And where that obelisk sits is right there in that pinch point. So you have multiple rings going around and all meeting right there where that obelisk is up there at that pinch point. And that's kind of what the – and that then works with the dome, which turns the opposite way, if you will. It turns outward and creates this space of lifting up and sending outward. So things are collected via the obelisk and then transmitted to the dome. The dome being the state capitals, which would then transmit via, you know. So the Masons, I suspect, you know, this phi proportion and all these kinds of geomancy type things were well known by the Templars and the builders of Europe, and they applied all these things all the time and knew about ley lines and currents. And it was just, you know, we got rid of it because it's an impediment to progress. When you start to look at, well, the Earth is alive, and no, you can't. The fairies live there. You can't build a highway there. You know, that type of thing was let go. But people end up being on these lines without knowing it. And they have a house full of fairies.
Wow, endangered fairies.
Yeah, they're running out of space to live, and they require lay energy. They require this electromagnetic stuff. I think we do too. The stuff that's carried in ley lines is like a mana in my eyes. It's I believe that the big hairy ones, those Sasquatch and Bigfoot, they live off to some degree, and it's this bioelectric thing. It feeds you, and here we are, being in this soup of this electromagnetic soup of, you know, artificial soup of Wi-Fi and various microwave projections. It's really messing with all the nature, the ability for nature to do its thing with electromagnetism, because everything is all, you know, kind of out of coherence.
Yes, you were one of the first to mention that back in 2012 in terms of the interfering with the natural telluric energy. And then Dr. Carmen Bolter, a past guest, had also mentioned the same thing, especially regarding the aerosol operations and our connection to telluric energy in the atmosphere. But I'd like to come back to that. I want to get down to the South Appalachian Ley intersection with the Washington Ley Line. And I found the area that you mentioned also near York, Pennsylvania. And I don't know if that is correct, but it's near Three Mile Island, you mentioned. But also I found near the Harley-Davidson manufacturing plant and near an area called the Seven Gates of Hell. So you have a lot going on with, of course, radioactivity, Harley-Davidson, and then the Seven Gates of Hell. It's interesting what's happening at this particular intersection.
Yeah, Jeff, you've really kind of taken my suggestion and ran with it and proven my theory. You know,
great.
It's well, there's many people doing this actually out on the web. They're, you know, chasing these meridians and seeing how things are all lined up, and there's a lot of things going on about, well, you know, the Illuminati have it all out there, and, you know, but I'm not quite sure. What inspired Harley-Davidson, which has that particular angle in its block, to that was where Harley-Davidson was actually invented as a,
I don't know, but it's a very big manufacturing plant. I don't know if that's the original spot, but it's one, you know, it's where one exists.
Yeah, and right near there is Hershey, Pennsylvania as well, which, boy, whew, chocolate. If there's anything this country likes, it's chocolate.
Indeed. Okay, now getting to the Seven Gates of Hell, you can go online to find information about it on Weird Pennsylvania, those series of books. And the information just goes on and on, but a lot of it's speculation and hearsay, compelling people to go out to the area at night and walk around and get scared. But it's another paranormal anomaly in these intersections.
Right. It's you know, you have the nuclear plant on there, you have the Three Mile Island, you have this Seven Gates of Hell. There's a certain, you know, thing that is suggesting that's along this particular meridian of 76 50. 77 seems to, you know, it, it, in looking at this, it feels like there's more than one meridian in operation here, coming down through on the east side of the 77th, the 7650. Jeff, you mentioned that it goes also down through the NSA building.
That was Peter Shampoo, author of many books, including Gaia Matrix. If you don't have a copy, it's highly recommended. So might there be a strange effect from the confluence of ley line intersections and piezoelectric energy moving through the bulk of quartz-filled granite? And you add in periodicity influences of the moon and the time of year, it might produce an interesting effect. The light phenomena recorded atop Brown Mountain, North Carolina, for instance, has been a sight to behold for centuries. Its numerous outcroppings are comprised of what's known as cranberry granite, and it's loaded up with quartz. According to Cherokee and Catawba lore, the two nations waged a terrible conflict on the mountain 800 years ago. Cherokees have legends of the mountain as a gateway, a door that leads to another realm. Whole villages are known to be relocated through this portal. A closer look at some of the beautiful ambient night photography revealing the Brown Mountain lights show more detail and what seem to be anthropomorphic figures within the lit-up areas. And I'll put a link on my site of that video. Are we then looking at a time storm, as paranormal British author Jenny Randles describes in her book by the same title? Meaning, is this event that appears to be flashes of light atop a mountain from our perspective, in another reality, a longer measure of time, such as months or years? And Michelle DeVries writes, the work of Jenny Randles and Politis alone can prove that a predatory force shares our world, and it appears to be embedded within the fabric of our reality and has the capability to use naturally occurring Earth anomalies to breach realities in order to cause physical and mental harm, often resulting in death. The victims from Randall's research actually survived their encounters, and Michelle's talking about time storms, offering an excellent, albeit disturbing, first-hand record of what may be occurring in Politis's missing 411 cases, which cover a mysterious haunting phenomena that has been documented for centuries and still occurs today. So she's saying the same thing here. Michelle continues, a single missing person should therefore be very easy to find. If a professionally trained tracking dog cannot pick up the person's scent, then the scent simply isn't there. Nature doesn't lie. So what happened to these people? And this is where Jenny Randall's information comes in, and she talks about evidence of spatial distortion. People and large objects plucked from one location and deposited somewhere else. And that's scattered through Jenny's book titled Time Storms. A witness moves some distance with no explicable means by which to do so. And this is Michelle DeBrieve's words here in her thesis, The Hidden Predator. But the implication of such instant transfer is that it happens by some means not consistent with ordinary science. In fact, this staple of science fiction known as teleportation is a disturbing feature of some time storms. An excellent example of teleportation occurred in 1880, and this is in Jenny's book, Jenny Randall's book. A local farmer, Sung Zishan from Songjishan County in China, encountered a misty light in some bushes and later discovered 2 weeks had simply gone by in a blink. He described feeling very strange, including a tingling paralysis, and that there was a humming, rushing noise. He then found himself floating upward and lost all sense of time and space. His very next recall, as if it had been a moment later, was of being found in a dazed state by a forester in Guizhou Province, 300 miles from his farm. Another example: in 1952, a 2-year-old boy from Ritter, Oregon, disappeared from his grandparents' farm after he was missing for 19 hours. A searcher found the boy in a creek bed 12 miles from the farm. He had climbed two mountains and over numerous fences. Newspaper article stated the boy must have run nonstop for 12 hours to get there. How is this possible? How many two-year-olds can run nonstop for 12 hours? The answer is none. In 1980, two friends were driving in Longmont, Colorado, when a blue glow enveloped their car, accompanied by a noise like rushing air. The next thing they knew, the car was sucked up off the road, and they were floating gravity-free for an unknown length of time. They were surrounded by a glowing mist and a smell of electric arcing. The next thing they knew, they were further down the road, and they don't even recall falling back onto the road. And this was an hour later. In 1981, a businessman in Lajares, Brazil, was separated from his car while driving to a meeting after a white glow surrounded the vehicle. Later that night, his wife reported him missing, and police found his car abandoned with the keys still in the ignition after the white glow took over the car. He felt a sense of pressure on him, making it hard to move, and pains in his muscles. Then he found himself in a dreamy, floating state, and the next instant he was coming to, with his body still sore and disoriented. The car was gone. The man walked to a pharmacy to buy some pain reliever and realized he had been deposited 600 miles from where his car was discovered by police. 5 days had passed, even though for him it was only a minute. Jenny Randles has 25 years of experience investigating scientific anomalies. She served as director of investigations at the British UFO Research Association for 12 years. She engaged in research with the Dr. J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies, the Association for Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomena, and UFO Investigators Network. And she has lectured and researched at MIT and Manchester University. Michelle DeVries writes in her Hidden Predator thesis, in the fall of 1947, during a trip to visit the Dalai Lama, 11 travelers experienced a red and gray time storm when they stopped in a small village late one afternoon. And this is in Time Storms by Jenny Randles. The timing of this time storm coincides with Politis finding that, quote, the vast majority of disappearances occur in the late afternoon or early evening. The incident also began with a sudden change in temperature from hot and humid to icy coldness. A woman from the group stated her skin was tingling, a prickling sensation, when she, quote, saw a strange red object. The locals recognized it and fled in terror at the sight of the floating apparition, saying afterward, the only thing to do when it appeared was to hide. The woman stated it didn't seem to have any particular shape. It was a very strange cloud. It was moving just above the surface, but definitely moving. I would say it was as big as a large house. The strange cloud then targeted the woman's truck and moved around it as if performing a military inspection. Quote, there was an extraordinary pressure in the air. The truck was actually vibrating. The air surrounding the party felt alive in an electric manner that none of them had ever experienced before. The woman described a strange cloud as appearing solid in the middle, but outside was like a fog or vapor. When it was right over her, she felt a strange pressure in the air and the terrible electrical tingling. Furthermore, there was silence, stillness, and timelessness. Then reality changed in an instant. There had been some sort of space-time dislocation. The entire party of travelers experienced some degree of sickness with vomiting and red, itchy rashes afterward, which lasted into the next day. They were all so disturbed by the experience, they canceled their trip and headed back to Nepal. another time storm incident with electromagnetic anomalies occurred in 1963 in the middle of the afternoon on the Western Atlantic. A ship towing a barge sailed into a strange uniform fog, which caused the compass to, quote, spin frantically around. The ship lost power to the motors, electrical equipment, for 10 minutes. After the fog passed, crew members checked the barge and reported the surface of the vessel was unexpectedly hot. In addition, several flashlights were not working. All the batteries were drained of power and could not be recharged. Very interesting. There are many examples within literature where the main character wanders through a forgotten passageway or hidden gate. In 1965, Alexander Key wrote The Forgotten Door. Alice in Wonderland, as many are familiar, and maybe more accurately representing a confluence of natural forces, The Wizard of Oz. You might recall past guest Dr. Judy Wood describing how a tornado event will activate a confluence of electricity, magnetics, and gravity to create a separation of atoms, known to allow, for example, a piece of straw to seemingly pierce through a tree. Now, the straw wasn't physically accelerated to a volatile speed to pierce the tree. It's suggesting a phasing occurred on the atomic level. That field effect was the mechanism for transportation in the film The Wizard of Oz, which is interesting because witnesses report around Brown Mountain, for example, they refer to something called the Oz factor when the woods go quiet and uneasiness fills the realm, and it's often the prelude to a missing 411 case. British ufologist David Clark writes in his article UFO Abductions and the Celtic Otherworld, quote, there are many tales of voyages to magical supernatural worlds. In the conic tale of Nera, the entrance to the other world was through a hole in a rock found by the hero, who was following this raiding party of dead warriors. And having entered this place, he had to stay there since he had become one of the dead. The mysterious underground caverns with their unearthly lighting and shamanic initiation rituals echo the alleged interiors of UFOs in the present day. In Celtic mythology, the other world may be reached through a cave, the waters of a lake, through a magic mist upon a magic boat or vessel, or through the granting of sudden insight. In the earliest Irish sagas, this land is called the Plain of the Two Mists. Uncanny mists, David writes, it should be noted, are a very common motif found in many close encounter experiences, and they are a fundamental element in the manifestation of ancestor spirits and gods in Celtic mythology. A strange green mist plays an important part in the famous Avely UFO abduction, which took place in Essex, southeast England in 1974. The Evis family reported how they had unaccountably experienced a period of missing time after passing through a strange bank of green mist in their car late at night, and it was only afterward that a full-blown abduction experience emerged under hypnosis. And this is from an article, a 1989 article by British ufologist David Clark. Now, when it comes to the Boulder profile points, Politis will often mention how the government in Iceland will build around boulders instead of moving them. The folklore tells of how certain boulders are homes for hidden people or the Holdu folk, and they are thought to live inside boulders, cliffs, and lava fields. I want to add here a potential yet fascinating connection. More than 10 years ago, Gladys, who posts on her YouTube channel GCE Peru, had consistently recorded anomalous activity on the side of a small mountain in Peru. She had a perfect view from her apartment window. The objects appear as large white bedsheets. Some of them are dark, but they're all mainly white, and they look like bedsheets. They're not perfectly square, but they move in these flowing ways. and they are intentionally flying in and around boulders on the mountainside. Some of these large flowing white shapes moving upon this Peruvian mountainous ridge would fly directly into the rocks themselves and vanish, as if they dissolved into solid rock, the solid rock face of a boulder. When the profile points of boulder fields or granite comes up in the missing persons case, this anomalous activity caught on video stands out to me as a possible connection. Is it a predator? I don't know. What is really interesting is GCE Peru, Gladys, posted another video of an eagle catching and attacking one of these entities. There are videos of Gladys singing to them, and they're responding with flashes of a lighter color. I caught something similar on video years ago in an abandoned field in Long Island City, across from Manhattan, one afternoon in May of 2015. It looked like the very same bed sheet type object that Gladys was catching in Peru. It appeared at the bottom edge of a cumulus cloud, and there it was flipping around against a bright blue sky. It was beautiful. And after recording it, I packed up and headed home. Or at least that was my intention. But something else happened. And here is my description of the event from a documentary I put together a few years ago titled New York Skywatch, A Decade of UFOs. In May 2015, my paranormal odyssey in this field ended with undercover police singling me out amid the many dog walkers and explorers who had actually worn a path through this field. On that day, I caught on video the closest UFO at the time. It looked like a giant white bedsheet. After the sighting, I packed up and started walking out of the field. A falcon flew right by my face. And looking back, it might have been a warning because undercover officers were in position to arrest me for trespassing. Three plainclothes officers with bulletproof vests stepped out of a tan SUV with a plumbing service sign on the door. One officer searched my backpack, another retraced my steps back behind the chain link fence and said she saw me drop something. She returns, puts on rubber gloves, and searches my pockets. I was nervous they might plant something on me. They talk to each other for a while, run my information, and decide to let me go. No arrest, nothing. I get home to review the footage of this close-up UFO. I press play, and right when I zoom into the UFO, the screen turns a solid blue. I can't explain it, but it's not uncommon for high-level interference events like this to transpire while UFO hunting. Essentially, that was it for filming at this location. This was May 2015, and I'd been catching UFOs in this area on video since 2006, and nothing came close to this level of layered interference to the point of arrest, all triggered by catching that bedsheet object on video. And my camera ultimately rejected it. It's as if the event was erased from time and space. I'd like to also point out how distinctly similar the activity of what Gladys is catching on video in Peru and what I randomly recorded in New York City and what Don Juan describes as the flyers. A notable difference is the implied colors of the flyers in Don Juan's story. It suggested they're black shadows. In GCE Peru's video, these flowing shapes or flyers are both black and white, and more often they appear as white. Most importantly, and the main reason I'm mentioning this, is how the flyers are seen to dissolve into rocks. The detail connects what very well could be the flyers, the ancient predator to the missing 411 boulder profile point. So in this first show about the hidden predator of missing 411 cases, we looked at the etheric parasite described by Jerry Marzinski. We also looked at the same energy harvest dynamic described in the 1818 Bible. The living waters would be what Robert Monroe calls louche. We've learned that this etheric predator has its domain in both urban and rural settings. The next part examined the role of granite, its piezoelectric nature, and the confluence of vortex energy created by ley line intersections that can produce field effects and an entrance into what David Clark calls the other world. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests. If you have any questions about this show, please email me at inothernewsradio@yahoo.com.